Hello and welcome to episode 102 of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Paradin, historian and deputy director of the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum here at Camp Shelby. And with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, retired Navy Captain Bill Todi, former skipper of the Fast Attack Submarine USS Indianapolis, Commodore of Submarine Squadron 3 in Pearl Harbor, and many other postings that make a list about as long as my arm. How you doing, Bill?
I'm doing well. Hey, Seth. Happy to be here again.
Excellent. Yeah, same here. Same here. So today we're going to discuss what happened after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, and specifically the invasion of the Philippines, and why things went south so fast for the Americans in the Philippines in the latter days of 1941 and the early days of 1942. So within hours of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, an attack that devastated the U.S. Pacific Fleet and seemingly allowed Japan a free hand in the Western Pacific, or anywhere, really, let's be honest, the Japanese attacked the Philippine Islands from the air. Days later, on December 10th, a small landing force invaded Luzon near Vigan. This was followed a couple of days later by landings on several other islands in the archipelago, including Lingayen Gulf on the 22nd of December. Now, the forces arrayed for this campaign, at least numerically on paper, were in the defenders' favor. The United States and the Filipinos possessed a 3-2 numerical advantage on the ground. And while that sounds imposing, it really wasn't. The majority of those listed as combatants really were not. The majority were service troops or Air Corps, and it was called the Air Corps in 1942. Actual combat troops available for defense were only around 9,500 men. The Americans also possessed a contingent of Army Air Corps fighters and bombers, P-40s and B-17s, as well as many other obsolete aircraft. But they didn't make much of an impact on the campaign at all. Their lack of an impact is one of the more sour points of the Philippine campaign, as we shall see. But let's start at the beginning. Bill, why did the Japanese invade the Philippines in the first place?
Now, the Philippines were the crossroad of the Southern Pacific, and if the Japanese were going to defend their sources of raw materials from places like Java, Malaya, Borneo, that all of that had to flow past the Philippines up towards Formosa and to to the islands, homeland of Japan. So if America continued to control the Philippines, particularly with air power, all of those commercial operations between where the Japanese got most of the raw materials and where they needed it to arrive would be under constant attack. So there was never any real doubt that Japan would need to take the Philippines. In fact, the Philippines was actually more valuable to Japan from a commercial standpoint than Hawaii was. It was more important to attack the Philippines and take the Philippines than it was to attack Hawaii. The only reason to attack Hawaii in Pearl Harbor, of course, was the center of gravity of the fleet, the Pacific Fleet in Hawaii.
You're 100% right. I mean, the Japanese, they had their eyeballs on the Philippines for years and years and years. And we knew this. This was nothing. We being the United States, of course, we knew this. This was nothing that was, unheard of or unthought of. We actually planned for a Japanese invasion for some time, and we'll get into that in a little bit. Right. Yeah. And we'll get into that in some detail in a bit. Mm-hmm. But the thing, and you hit the nail right on the head immediately as soon as you said raw materials. Japan being an island nation, they're low on raw materials in the first place. And the Philippines had huge reserves of rubber. They had oil reserves, bauxite, other different natural resources that would fuel the Japanese war machine. And they needed to get that stuff. They needed that in the Philippines. They also needed to go into the Dutch East Indies too, which is all part of that same kind of area of operations. Large area of operations, but area of operations altogether. And it was a high priority target, if you will, for the Japanese from day one. And I mean, that goes to show you that, on December 8th, because we're across the international dateline here, the Japanese were preparing to launch an aerial assault, the following day. And I mean, in 2 days later, they landed troops and small amount of troops, but they did land some troops in Luzon 2 days later. So, I mean, they were ready to strike right off the bat and hit the Philippines and take the Philippines. And I think, something that, again, you hit the nail on the head is that it was closer to Japan than was Hawaii or than is Hawaii. And in such a way that the Japanese figured that if they knocked our fleet out of Pearl Harbor, which of course they did, that they would be essentially given a free hand in the Philippines because we couldn't really do anything to stop them.
Yeah. The Japanese had a great strategy for taking the Philippines. It started with destruction of our defensive air power, and that worked extremely well, better than it should have. And that's largely due to ineptness on the American side, and we can talk about that. And the land invasion, the greatest amphibious assault in history up until that time, occurred only after they neutralized our air power. Mm-hmm. And I think they were surprised by the degree, the ease with which they were able to neutralize our air power. And in fact, the landings, as you said, we had numerical support superiority. Many of our defensive ground forces, army combatant forces primarily, and Philippine scout forces, we're not prepared for this. But I hasten to add that one of the divisions, or one of the brigades that was brought in by the Japanese, were reservists that hadn't had any training either. Mm-hmm. And two of the most potent army units of the Japanese force, once they got ashore, were retrograded and rerouted to assist with the Japanese attack and occupation in the South Pacific. So the Japanese also had troops that weren't prepared, and some of their most effective troops were pulled out before they ever saw major combat. But really the question that's been pondered by historians since December of 1941 is, why our Philippine forces were so ill-prepared for an assault they knew was coming, and why MacArthur decided to abandon a war plan that was 20 years in the development,
right,
and adopt a strategy that any West Point cadet would have known was a losing strategy with the logistic forces he had at his disposal, that in fact failed within hours of implementation.
Right. And I mean, it's across the board. And I mean, everything pins on MacArthur because he was overall commander, as it should be, frankly, as you, a former commanding officer yourself, knows that the buck stops at the top. It stops here. And I mean, there was ineptitude across the board. There was some incredible bravery, mind you.
Absolutely.
By Filipinos and American soldiers and airmen. But the ineptitude outweighed the ability to actually put up a strong defense. And it starts on the air, or actually quite the opposite, on the ground, because as you said, that the Philippines were fully aware of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. They received word at 0200 on December the 8th. Official word came 3 hours later, but it was a known thing that Pearl Harbor had been attacked. It was also a known thing that they were probably going to be next. And the only way that they could strike at the Japanese was via the air with our B-17s, of which, now granted, we didn't have a ton of them there, but we did have, two full squadrons of B-17s there, heavy bombers at the time, that were perfectly able to get out and strike Japanese forces as they were coming in, or strike them before they came in. And in fact, that actually was one of the plans. That was the plan to launch an attack the following day with the B-17s, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And, General Sutherland, who was MacArthur's deputy, mm-hmm. blocked access to MacArthur by the air commander. That's one of the great, tragedies of the early hours. But, I hasten to point out that General Short, who was responsible for the air defense of Hawaii during the attack on Pearl Harbor, was pilloried, was relieved for cause and pilloried, and, never recovered from that. And, and that was a surprise attack that technically he didn't know was coming. MacArthur, his forces were completely destroyed. Tens of thousands of soldiers forced to surrender, and we'll get to that, was a few months later. But he receives the Medal of Honor, for an attack that he knew was coming. when his force was completely wiped out.
Right.
And that's just one of the great ironies of those events that transpired beginning December 7th through March and April of 1942.
Yeah, it's, the Medal of Honor for MacArthur. I smell another episode coming up soon with
piling on a MacArthur for a different episode.
You're right, but you're 100% right. I mean, what you said is 100% accurate, 100% accurate. But the thing, the heartbreaking thing is that, I mean, you could sit here and what if all day long about the American Air Forces that were in the Philippines on December 8th, 9th, 10th. But the bottom line is that they failed miserably.
Destroyed on the ground.
A lot of them were. And, you know, so it's a bit of a myth that all of the aircraft were on the ground. And of course, that's not true. I mean, a great deal of them were. Most of the B-17s actually were. And they were being prepped for a dusk raid on Formosa, which is where the Japanese aircraft were known to be staging and coming from. And that's actually where they did come from. They were being prepped for a dusk raid, and they were caught flat-footed on the ground by the Japanese coming in, and they were just lit up. I mean, they were just absolutely destroyed. I think there were only two or three that were airborne at the time, maybe two. I don't recall exactly the numbers right now that were airborne. They're the only two that were saved or that were serviceable, and even they weren't serviceable for very long. But I mean, it's a thing that you can't help but look at it that, you know, the defenders of Pearl Harbor, who had no warning, well, very little warning. We talk about that in our first episode, but very little warning that
no actionable intelligence.
Right. Thank you. Yes, exactly. That anything was going to happen. They were able to scramble a few aircraft, P-40s, and they downed a total of 8 Japanese aircraft over Pearl Harbor, which is not a ton, obviously, but they gave a fairly decent showing of themselves, considering that they had no warning. In the Philippines, where they had plenty of warning, these aircraft, of which there were significantly more in the air, only downed 7 enemy aircraft. So, I mean, there's really no excuse as to what happened there and why the showing for the Army Air Corps was so poor in the Philippines between December 8th and December, really the 18th, 19th, is they were just absolutely shelled. They were destroyed.
What the Japanese were afraid of, and what we should have done, was that we would reposition those aircraft in Mindanao, because that would have been out of the range of the Japanese, you know,
exactly,
bombers. Right. And so we would have been able to save our air cover, which would have caused, then we would have had air support for the ground troops when the invasion began. And so, I mean, it would have been a dogfight, no doubt. I mean, it would have been, you know, that we would have been doing defensive counter air, and they would have been doing offensive counter air. It would have been, you know, I'm not suggesting that the ultimate outcome would have been any different, but the speed with which we failed would have been significantly different. So, and of course, we didn't do that. And the Japanese were surprised to how easy it would be.
Yeah. And you're 100% right again. And that, you know, I don't think it's kind of like Pearl Harbor we talked about, you know, last week, is that, you know, I think the failure or the surrender of the Philippines rather was inevitable. But I think had we had some air support by, as you said, moving the 17s to Mindanao or elsewhere, I mean, it's an archipelago. There's a lot of places to put these airplanes that they could have, if they'd have prepared properly, it would have, you know, stalled the inevitable, I think, a little bit longer, and you know, we wouldn't have won, but it might not have been quite as bad.
So reason we lost the Philippines so quickly, number one, is the loss of our air cover. In fact, the Asiatic fleet, which is commanded by Admiral Hart, who is Annapolis classmate, strangely enough, with MacArthur's older brother, and knew Admiral MacArthur well, General MacArthur well, said, you know, about, and said something about, you know, Douglas is certain about things that just ain't so, and that makes him dangerous. Hart realized that without air cover, that his fleet and his Asiatic fleet was tiny. I mean, it was one heavy cruiser, a couple of light cruisers, and some support vessels, some PT boats, and some submarines. he said, you know, this fleet will not last 20 minutes, which is not an exaggeration. Mm-hmm. And so he did the right thing and got them out, because they would have been of zero value during the Japanese landings that followed. But failure number two was MacArthur's abandonment of the strategy that the United States had taken 20 years to develop, mm-hmm. which was a
war plan, orange,
essentially a war plan orange, a defense in depth strategy that would have caused attrition of the Japanese forces as the Americans built a basically fortress on Bataan and Corregidor. Instead, what MacArthur decided he was going to do, in his words, hit them where they ain't, which was ludicrous because the actual strategy involved going where they were, not where they ain't.
Right.
And it was a defend the beaches strategy. And he did not have the forces or the logistics to defend the beaches. You know, millennia ago, Sun Tzu said, if you're going to do something like MacArthur wanted to do, you needed to outnumber the enemy 5-1.
Exactly.
Not 3-2, which was the actual, you know, advantage that we had, 3-2, but 5-1. And he didn't have that. But he did spread his logistics all over the country to support a defend the beaches strategy. And then when he had to abandon the defend the beaches strategy, which was very early in the campaign, mm-hmm. and fall back to Bataan, which was War Plan Orange, the logistics were spread all over the country and weren't there to support General Wainwright's army forces that were holed up in Bataan, which led to another tragedy. So this is, you know, we're talking about three failures here. Failure number one was the very rapid failure of air power. Failure number two was MacArthur's abandonment of a very mature, very robust War Plan Orange strategy. And failure number three was the logistics failure to support what could only be the final, you know, resort to the final defense in Bataan, which led to widespread starvation, disease, and the eventual surrender of Wainwright's forces on Bataan.
MacArthur's plan wanted to defend the beaches. And, you know, you would think that when you want to defend a beach or beaches from an amphibious invasion that you know is coming, and got a pretty good idea of where it's coming, Lingayen Gulf, because, you know, the Japanese did it, and then we did it again three years later.
3 years later, yeah.
Same place, damn near. That you're going to send your best forces down there to hold those areas. He didn't even do that. He sent some of his weakest units out there, which were the Filipinos, and this is not to harangue the Filipinos at all. You know, a lot of them fought
bravely.
A lot of them fought with extraordinary bravery.
Absolutely.
However, these units were not properly trained for any
or
kind
equipped.
Of or That's equipped right. for any mm-hmm. kind of beach defense. And even if they were, the roads to those areas, the Philippines, I mean, this is 1941, early 42. The roads in those areas were dirt. You mm-hmm. know, there were two main highways on Luzon. And even those at the best places were still, you know, coral packed. They weren't concrete. They weren't blacktop. There was none of this. The roads were bad, as bad as they were, getting supplies from where they were to where they needed to be was absolutely difficult, to put it mildly. And then on top of that, without any air cover, you're exposing your people, your supply columns, and your defenders to constant air attack. Now, I guess you could say, thankfully, that the Japanese, in the early part of the invasion, they were not really able to exploit too much of their air superiority because they had been worn down to a bit by maintenance more than anything else and weather. But it was a flawed plan to begin with, and that he sent his worst troops to the beaches to defend. And even and at the first sight of the Japanese, those people broke and ran, you know, I mean, yeah. And it was a constant thing for the vast majority of the early part of the campaign, that when the Filipino troops, who were poorly, poorly trained, poorly, poorly equipped, saw the Japanese coming at them, they didn't even put up a fight hardly at all. They just boom up in the hills.
I spent some time in the Philippines in the 80s and 90s, and the roads weren't much better then. So I can imagine the way they were in 1941, 42. So, you know, with the, you know, when the Japanese finally did land, they did a classic pincer movement around Manila,
right,
as one would expect. I mean, there was no surprise there. That's exactly what we would have done. And so what MacArthur tried to do with the city of Manila and declare it an open city, hoping that the Japanese would save it if it was a open or neutral,
right,
city once they landed. Seth, what do you think about that?
Well,
what did we learn in China about the Japanese behavior and what it might suggest as it pertained to how they might treat Manila?
Nanking. That's exactly all you really got to say. But you know, I can understand MacArthur's desire to open Manila, or have Manila be an open city. You know, I mean, he was a Filipinophile, if you want to, mm-hmm, if there is such a thing. He was, and he wanted to spare the Pearl of the Orient, and that's what it was called, from the utter destruction that he probably knew was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think him declaring it an open city was grasping at straws, frankly. But I mean, the Japanese proved what everybody thought they were actually going to do by just, you know, I mean, absolutely devastating Manila.
They were brutal.
Oh, horrible. Yeah. I mean, yeah, they were, well, and we can get into that, you know, if we want, is the occupation of the Philippines by the Japanese. And I think that's a whole nother episode in and of itself.
Yeah, I agree.
Is it was, you know, brutal is not even the word for it, mm-hmm, frankly. It was animalistic, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
But which is, you know, basically exactly their behavior in every occupied country that they were in. But yeah, I mean, their history in China and other locales, you know, that they had conquered and were occupying should have told MacArthur all he needed to know as to what Manila was going to suffer through as he was pulling his people out. And, you know, we talk about, you know, the first initial invasion days when the Japanese landed in Lingayen and that pincer movement, mm-hmm, is going in there, and they are rolling through American and Filipino defenses like a hot knife through butter. I mean, they are just creaming the defenders out of there. And this is when MacArthur says, you know, we've talked about it briefly, you know, we're gonna institute a line of defense down on the Bataan Peninsula. And he did it at the wrong time. While it wasn't necessarily the wrong call, he did it at the wrong time. You know, it should have been the initial thing. That should have been the first, mm-hmm, thing he did, not the, you know, fifth thing he did. And when he did it, it was in such that the defending troops were in such disarray from
already weakened.
Yeah, yep. from the shock assaults of the Japanese infantry and armored units that were coming at them, they left a lot of their stuff behind. You touched on that, and that, you know, the defenders of Bataan were, you know, rife with disease, and they were low on food, and or really didn't have any food. They were killing their, you know, their animals and eating those, and
cavalry killing their horses.
Oh yeah, I mean, that's, you know, and that's not the only thing they were eating, but I mean, mm-hmm, it was bad all the way up and down the line, and it could have been better had the plan been followed that had been put in place for 20 years. And that just wound up putting the defenders who were hunkered down on the Bataan Peninsula that held there for a long time, mind you, in a horrible, horrible place for a very long time with lack of food, lack of medical supplies, lack of ammunition. And it was a situation that was worsened by his being MacArthur's late decision to do the right thing.
And self-delusion. I mean, we're going to do another episode just on MacArthur's, but if I can tease that episode a little bit.
Go for it.
It started with his delusion about what happened at Pearl Harbor. He initially reported to everybody that the Japanese had suffered a great defeat. And then he reported to General Marshall, the chief of staff of the army, that they were greatly outnumbered by the Japanese, which in fact was not true. By the way, until I moved to Florida, I lived about 2 miles from General Marshall's house in Leesburg, Virginia, and used to visit often. It's a great place. So there was a self-delusion as it pertained to the order of battle of the Japanese. The order of battle of the Japanese was very well understood by MacArthur's staff. And for some reason, he continued to live in this state of denial. It was said that he lived in he created an alternate universe that he lived in and spoke about that was so distracting, so deliberately misleading that it made everything worse. The reports he gave to Marshall were wrong. The reports he gave to his staff about what Marshall had promised him was wrong. The support he promised Wainwright and then never delivered was wrong. Just everything that he touched. If there is an opposite of the Midas touch, if there is such a thing as the opposite of the Midas touch, where everything he touched turned to crap, MacArthur had it. And so, you know, this just accelerated. It was one tragedy after another. Yeah. Even the promise he made to Wainwright when he was ordered to evacuate, although that was one order he was very happy to keep. Oh, yeah. When he was ordered to evacuate, and he said, "I'm going to get to Australia. I'm going to regroup, reassemble forces, and I'll be right back with as much as I could bring to bear," was a lie. And he knew it was a lie. He knew there was nothing in Australia he could regroup and bring back. But it was like, why do you give somebody false hope that all you need to do is hold out a month or two and I shall return? And it was a lie.
He gave up false hope all the time. You know, you touched briefly on Admiral Hart, and I want to get into this here in a second. But Admiral Thomas Hart, after the fall of the Philippines, after it was over, really, frankly, when MacArthur got to Australia, he just hammered on Hart because he said that Hart abandoned his people, that the Navy took off and they ran away. Well, the Navy was under orders to pull out, first of all. Mm. They were under orders from Washington to get the hell out of there. Yeah, save what little of it there was. But regardless, they were told, get out. So they did exactly as they were ordered. They got the hell out of there. And
particularly after Pearl Harbor. Right. Where we had everything destroyed there. It was like all we had left.
Right. And that wasn't much. Yeah. But he is on record as telling, going around the lines, the front lines, on the Bataan Peninsula, and telling the soldiers there, saying, "Oh, the Navy's coming. The Navy's coming. They're bringing their, this and that and the other, and the battleships and aircraft carriers are coming. And we're, just hold out another couple of weeks." Now, granted, in his defense, which I'm loath to say, but in his defense, he's not going to walk around and say, "Hey, look, guys, the situation is crap. We're all done for. So I'm leaving later." Mm-hmm. He's not going to do that. And if he did, I don't think he would have made it off the island alive. But I mean, what he told those people was an outright lie. And the thing is that those guys were not stupid. They knew, at this point, weeks and going into months, help wasn't coming. Help was not coming. And the thing was that it was a known thing even before Pearl Harbor that if the Philippines were attacked, and this goes into Admiral Hart, if the Philippines were attacked, that they were pretty much indefensible. And Admiral Hart was one of the first guys that publicly said that if we're attacked out here, there's nearly not a whole heck of a lot we can do. And this was not a mirage. This is exactly what happened. There wasn't much that anybody could do. Even if the U.S. Pacific Fleet had not been torpedoed literally in Pearl Harbor, they weren't coming out there. They were not sortieing the battle wagons out of Pearl to come and fight the Japanese on the high seas. It wasn't going to happen. It was too far. We didn't have the fuel capability at that time in Hawaii to get them out there, fight a battle, and then get out of there. It just wasn't going to happen. And everybody knew it.
One of the great ironies of U.S. military history is that Major Eisenhower had been MacArthur's aide-de-camp for many years in the Philippines. And as these events were transpiring, newly promoted General Eisenhower was head of the Army War Plans Department in Washington, D.C. And when he saw the reorganization that MacArthur was implementing in the Philippines in response to the attacks and things like that, Eisenhower said to Marshall, "It appears that he continues to prioritize the bootlickers over the warfighters," or words to that effect, right? Eisenhower knew exactly what MacArthur was going to be doing. And because of the public sentiment, MacArthur would continue to send out these press releases that were self-aggrandizing, mm-hmm. and were making him out to be a great hero in the face of all this. And then let the record show that the first two medals of honor awarded during World War II were awarded to soldiers defending in Wainwright's command on the Bataan Peninsula, mm-hmm. and they were extremely well deserved. And as MacArthur sends these press releases out, does he talk about that?
No, of course not.
He talks about courageous General MacArthur. These are press releases that he wrote himself. Right. Himself, courageous General MacArthur was nearly killed by a bomb that exploded 10 feet from him while he was leading troops on the Bataan Peninsula. And this was at a time he had not yet ever visited the Bataan Peninsula. And so he continued to create this mythology and use his dying troops to build up his own personal reputation. And these were and the public was buying it. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm teasing our episode on MacArthur. But the point I'm making here is that Eisenhower, Marshall, and even Roosevelt knew MacArthur well, knew that he was lying, but knew that the public loved him and there wasn't much they could do about it to ameliorate the situation in the Philippines during this period of time.
There was nothing we could do. There was nothing at all that we could do. And I mean, the guys that were there, that were stuck in the Philippines, you know, they knew that. I mean, I'm sure there were a few young green soldiers and sailors and Marines who thought, mm-hmm. well, you know, maybe, yeah, you know, maybe they are coming. But I mean, anybody with any kind of sense after, you know, if you're looking into March of 1942, because I mean, you know, it began in December of 41. Mm-hmm. And this is something I want to talk about. You know, we've been just bashing MacArthur and the Philippines, you know, and the whole command structure, and rightfully so. But there was some real, real heroism there by the defending Absolutely. Troops, by American troops and Filipinos.
And Filipino.
Filipino scouts. The Philippine scouts were, I mean, elite. They were the elite of the Filipino army, but they would have been elite in the American army. I mean, these guys were good at what they did, and they were tough. Jungle fighters, mm-hmm. and you know,
became the core of the insurgency,
right,
to continue to fight the Japanese after occupation.
Exactly.
But go ahead.
With a lot of American help, mm-hmm. and you know, as we did pull our people back to the Bataan Peninsula and held there, you know, especially along the Abuque line right there, and we held those defensive positions for months. You know, the Japanese steamroller ran into a couple of heavy defensive lines that frankly stopped them.
It didn't
kill the invasion, obviously, because they were still there. But I mean, it stopped them. They hit a hard brick wall, and
these were the first bonsai attacks of the war for against
us,
the States,
yeah, right?
And the American soldiers that were watching bodies pile up against barbed wire fences and things like that, being mowed down by American and Filipino machine guns, were just shocked at the willingness of these Japanese soldiers to just die without hope.
And the casualties that were inflicted on the Japanese, and this is something, you know, if you look at movies that were made in the era, and I'm a fan, and I know you are too, Bill, of Hollywood movies, especially of the 40s era and dealing with World War II, you know, they show heavy casualties on the American side. And that's very true. Mm-hmm. But they don't show a whole heck of a lot of casualties on the Japanese side for whatever reason. There's Bataan, the movie Bataan does to some extent, but whatever. But we inflicted a lot of casualties on these people, so much so that General Homma, the mm-hmm. Japanese general in charge, basically had to stop their offensive because they were running out of human beings to throw at the wall. His people were sick. They were running low on ammunition. They had, you know, thousands of wounded, thousands of dead. And he was basically running out of people to continue to throw into the meat grinder.
Well, this was essentially a siege, right?
And right. But it became
he should have done that. It became a siege. He should have done that earlier. You're right. The outcome was by no means assured for him at that point, right? When if he kept throwing bodies at our defenses, he might have lost. I mean, but he was smart enough to stop. when he had enough people left to say, look, these folks have no food. Mm-hmm. They're being, you know, beaten by disease, malaria, beriberi, you know, dysentery is killing off Americans. All I have to do is wait. All I have to do is not die faster than them.
Yep.
And they're going to be put in a position where they're going to have to surrender. That's a siege, which is eventually what he did.
Yeah. Yeah. And he had requested, you know, more support from Tokyo. Homa did. He requested more support from Tokyo, basically more infantry, and was told, no, you will do this with what you have and you will get it done now. You know, the face of the army was at stake. You know, they were they had to save face, and he was sent in there to basically steamroll everything, which in the beginning, that's exactly what he's done. And I think a little bit of the this goes back to, you know, what Yamamoto at one time called victory disease. You know, the Japanese had taken everything so quickly. Mm-hmm. Not just in the Philippines, but like,
they,
you know,
thought it would continue to be easy.
Yeah. Yeah. And then when it showed that it wasn't going to be quite as easy, mm-hmm. you know, they put the thumb on Homa's back and said, you're going to do this. And he did exactly what you said. He just basically sat there and said, all right, well, the hell with these people. They're going to die anyway. We're just going to wait on them to throw up the white flag, which is eventually, of course, what the defenders of Bataan and Corregidor were forced to do. Mm-hmm. You know, the surrender went up and it was devastating. It was over 90,000 Americans and Filipinos were captured by the Japanese. There were more Americans and Filipinos that were captured by the Japanese than there were Japanese in the Philippines.
Right.
Which I'll tell you all
and
you need to
Bataan
know.
That's Bataan and Corregidor both.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Combined.
Yeah. Because I think we had about 25,000 in Bataan Americans. And then you probably twice that number of Filipinos.
Oh, easy.
And then Corregidor, we had about 15,000. And of course, on March 11th, I think, MacArthur had been evacuated out of Corregidor as well with his family. He had his wife and his son there, refusing to evacuate them to the United States, even though he knew war was coming, because I think he believed it. That this was some kind of destiny for him, kind of like Patton mm-hmm. in Europe, or at least as the movie Patton portrays it, that he believed this was manifest destiny for him and he would be protected, ergo his family would be protected.
Right.
But no, he had to be evacuated. There was no protection in any of this. In fact, he began a rumor that he had volunteered to resign his commission and go to Bataan as a common foot soldier. Of course, none of it was true, but it was a wonderful rumor that he and that his wife and son would be abandoned in these PT boats, and then he would remain behind. Of course, he never gave that a serious moment of thought.
No, heck no. No, I mean, when he was ordered out, I'm sure that was one of the bright points of his Filipino experience or Philippine experience right there. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was, what was it, March 11th? He was evacuated out of there.
Yeah, I think so.
He was put on the PT boat and right. PT boats, plural.
Four and, of them, I think.
Yeah. And they were pulled out of there and, you know, in the dark of night. And basically he left Skinny Wainwright to hang, left him out to dry.
Skinny Wainwright was skinny, but not as skinny as he would be 3 years later. After 3 years in captivity as a POW of the Japanese.
Very, very true.
And the bright spot in all of this for Wainwright is that he was allowed to be present during the Japanese surrender in Tokyo Bay on the USS Missouri. Right. So he was one of the Americans that was on aboard Missouri during the Japanese surrender. And in fact, he was there to accept the Philippine surrender of the Japanese as well.
Mm-hmm. And he deserved it. He deserved the honor.
I think he deserved it. He's promoted to 4-star, but he only lived a few years after that. I think before he got captured, he was a heavy drinker.
Big time.
And then after he got captured, of course, his health deteriorated during his time in captivity. He wasn't very stout.
No.
Ever.
No.
And he was very weak after the war. He died in 1953.
He was physically weak too, and it, you know, from what you said, you know, being a capture a prisoner of war of the Japanese was never something that anybody wanted to be, and they certainly were not treated very well, even if he was a general, it frankly didn't matter. But if you look at footage of him or pictures of him during the surrender, when he's sitting at the table across from Homa, mm-hmm. and they're, you know, Homa's basically screaming at him because he is, you look at Wainwright, and the man is done. Mm-hmm. Like, he's done. You know, he's just done.
He's spent. Yeah, he, absolutely
completely.
Right.
He's physically mm-hmm. done. He's emotionally done. He's mentally done. I mean, there's footage of him, and, you know, and he's grabbing, he's rubbing his face, and, you know, I mean, he's utterly exhausted, and he's just, there's no gas left in the tank. And mm-hmm. I think that footage of him at the surrender table is, you know, it's a perfect example of all of the Americans and Filipinos that were back there on the Bataan Peninsula, or at least a great majority of them, is that they too were done. You know, they had mm-hmm. done the best that they could. And, you know, as we said, they did quite a bit. I mean, their defensive fighting right there on the Bataan Peninsula was, frankly, something to be admired. You know, I mean, they really, really put up a great defense and inflicted a lot of casualties and hung out a lot longer than was thought. But they too were done. You know, they were rife Absolutely. With disease. You know, they were starving, literally. And then, you know, after surrender, they get into the Bataan Death March, which is another episode I think we should cover, is, you know, treatment of prisoners of war by the Japanese.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. You know, it's a nadir in American military history, the Death March.
Yeah.
Because there were, and people forget, there were doctors and female nurses.
Yes.
That were captured as well, right? Yes. So, and they were all party to that Death March. So there's been a debate since 1942, mostly by amateurs, who suggest that the American Army, the United States Army, erred by not retrograding or evacuating soldiers from Bataan and Corregidor when, you know, before it got too bad. What do you think about that, Seth? Was that ever an option?
I don't think it was. What are you going to evacuate them with? Exactly. How are you going to get them out of there?
Yeah.
You know, again, the PAC fleet was destroyed in Pearl Harbor, or the vast majority of it was. And even if it wasn't, they're not going to get over there. They're not going to send the Nevada to, you know, the Bataan Peninsula to load them up and to have a Operation Magic Carpet like they did in 45. It's not going to happen in 41, 42. We didn't have the resources to do it.
Even if you used commercial shipping
right.
out of Singapore or something like that, it's
they couldn't do it there either because the Japanese were there.
The Japanese controlled the air. Nothing, and they would have died. I mean, it was there was no way those ships would have survived an evacuation to Australia, which is where they would have had to get. Because that's really the only bit of Allied territory that was defensible in early 1942. So that was not a real option. Mm-hmm. So those folks were going to fight. I think that it would have been better if they had known that this was, you know, do what you can. And then when you decide you can't do anymore, you make the call as mm-hmm. to when you're going to give up. Although, you know, the question as to is dying fighting the Japanese on Bataan or dying in a Japanese POW camp, the old death by fire, death by ice question, mm-hmm. right, which is better. I think that would have plagued them. But at least they would have been able to make an informed decision, although most people who had any common sense at all knew that there was going to be no rescue. And
right.
So they knew the situation they were in.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So when the Americans do, allies, I guess you want to say it, because Americans, Filipinos surrender in the Philippines in May of 1942, Corregidor falls, and it's all over with in May 1942, while Battle of Coral Sea is beginning, by the way. The news is spread across the United States like a thunderbolt. I mean, it doesn't mm-hmm. take long, you know, and the news of the Pacific War from December 7th to this point is all bad. You know, mm-hmm. there's a couple of bright spots, and those are, you know, we'll talk about those in the future. But this is a real gut punch to not only the American morale at home, but the American military, you know, especially mm-hmm. the United States Army and, the Army Air Corps, soon to be called the Army Air Forces. You know, this is in the Navy. This is a real, but more so the Army. This mm-hmm. is a real gut punch because, I mean, you know, it falls back on what we talked about last week. It's this superiority complex that the American military had over the Japanese. And now in, you know, March, April, May 1942, that whole, you know, oh, we're better than the little bucktooth Japanese thought, it's flipped the opposite. Mm-hmm. Now these people being the Japanese are unbeatable. You know, right. They're these superhuman jungle fighters. And frankly, you know, there's an element of fear involved mm-hmm. when it comes to the Japanese army and the Japanese Imperial Japanese Navy. And it's amazing how quickly
because people turned. Did know that we had the greater numbers there, mm-hmm. right? The only one who seemed not to know that is MacArthur. But you're right. But the reaction was kind of bifurcated. On one hand, it was Japanese are superior. We got no hope. On the other hand, there were editorials popping up all over the country that said MacArthur is a military genius and we should put him in charge of the entire Pacific War.
Oh, yeah.
Help me, Obi-Wan, MacArthur, you're our only hope kind of thing, right? And the second reaction really boggles my mind, given the first, right?
Right.
And so, but it was happening. It was real. It was not, of course, MacArthur was planting most of these stories and people were going along with it. Mm-hmm. And today that would never happen. I mean, you would have a very critical press questioning. It doesn't matter how much of a brilliant military genius this person is. The genius would be challenged based on the outcome.
Oh, yeah.
And so, there's a whole bunch of the MacArthur elements of the story that would not survive 2022 press. We'll talk about that in the MacArthur episode. But it was just really bizarre to me that here's a guy who lost, despite having warning, he lost as bad, let's be honest with ourselves, as bad as Kimmel and Short lost in Pearl Harbor, actually lost more people, mm-hmm. 90,000 yep. Allies surrendering. And yet he's, you know, put on a pedestal. You wouldn't believe it, right? You would say, this is fiction, except it really happened.
Yeah. And he made it up himself. And like you said before, the people bid it. You know, took it hook, line and sinker. And yeah, he was still employed. And mm-hmm. that's the thing that amazes me. But again, yeah. we're getting ahead of ourselves here. Yeah. But, it's a tragedy in history, really, when you look at the fall of the Philippines, and not just for the American Army and Marine Corps and the Navy and the Air Corps and soon to be Army Air Forces and the Filipinos. But it's just, you know, it's a tragedy of history that I think, much like Pearl Harbor, like we talked about last week, was inevitable. It was something that was going to happen. And, as we've discussed, there were certain things that maybe might have delayed the inevitable, wouldn't have changed it, but delayed the inevitable. One would be, of course, a change in command or a good commander. Two would have been, you know, functioning air support. And it's a very, very dark point in our history. Yeah.
But the Pearl Harbor attack, I agree that it was unavoidable, had a silver lining in that it accelerated our transformation for naval doctrine and naval strategy into an air-dominated, carrier-based fighting force and it converted the submarine force into its rightful role, which is to starve mm-hmm. the Japanese. There was no silver lining in the loss of the Philippines.
No.
It accelerated nothing. It transformed nothing. It was just tragedy from beginning to end.
Yep. And, you know, I'm sure we'll get comments or arguments and saying, oh, well, you know, it tied down a lot of Japanese forces. And it did to a point, but it didn't stop the Japanese from doing anything they wanted to do.
Absolutely right.
Because if you look at that point from December through May of 42, the Japanese are still... You know, they're still pushing. They're still conquering a lot of territory.
It wasn't a very large Japanese force. It was almost a constabulary force that held the Philippines until we started landing in Leyte and later Lingayen, just like the Japanese did, right?
Right.
And you know, that was one of the reasons we were able to move so quickly once we started invading, is the Japanese had long since lost the ability to resupply the Philippines, because the effect that we had on their, you know, resupply forces. But you know, it tied down some Japanese mm-hmm. forces, but as you said, they were able to do anything they wanted to do.
Yeah. And I mean, it was, you know, the whole thing of, you know, the sacrifice in the Philippines, you know, allowed us to do others. It's not true at all. The sacrifice in the Philippines was a tragedy, and it didn't allow us or anybody else to do anything, because the Japanese were still able to do whatever they wanted, and we couldn't do squat. Mm-hmm. And you know, I mean, we could do a little, but we couldn't do anything out in the Philippine area. You know, we couldn't do anything about that. I mean, I could go on and on and on, but we're running out of time. You got anything you want to close out with? Cause I got one thing I want to read to people here, but
no, just, I think that the Philippines was the first place where the American forces proved that under roughly equal circumstances, they could fight toe to toe with the Japanese.
Yes.
If they had been properly supplied and the logistics had been established the way it had been set in War Plan Orange, until MacArthur decided to discard, you know, this war plan, you know, I think they could have lasted 6-8 months. And maybe by that time, the balance of forces would have been a little bit different, right? Who knows how Guadalcanal would have, you know, gone and all the other battles that followed. The carrier raids, mm-hmm. which, you know, I think we need to do an episode on.
For sure.
And all of those could have assisted with the defense. And so, you know, the fact that it fell so quickly, none of those options were available to us. And that's the real tragedy here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, we talk about the hopelessness of the defenders of the Philippines. And it's encapsulated in a poem that was written by a war correspondent. And it goes like this. It says, "We're the battling bastards of Bataan. No mama, no papa, no Uncle Sam. No aunts, no uncles, no nephews, no nieces. No pills, no planes, no artillery pieces. And nobody gives a damn."
A damn.
Yep. And with that, I think we're going to wrap this one up. I want to thank everybody for listening. I appreciate it very much. We hope that you subscribe and like our podcast and follow us on any platform that you receive your podcasts on. And I'm Seth Paradin here at the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum and at Camp Shelby. And I want to thank you, Bill.
Bill Toedy, retired Navy captain, long retired Navy captain, and thanks for listening.
Yep, and we'll see you guys next week. Thanks.